From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a new detective in the world of TV mysteries, Adrian Monk. He's a brilliant crime solver, but he's also obsessive-compulsive and is constantly distracted by such concerns as whether he remembered to lock the door. This new comedic mystery series premieres tomorrow night. We'll talk with the star, Tony Shalhoub, and the writer, Andy Breckman. Lovely and Amazing is a new film about a mother and her three daughters who are all insecure about their looks. We'll talk with writer-director Nicole Holofcener and star Catherine Keener. And rock historian Ed Ward remembers the early days of the Byrds. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Several top congressional Democrats called on President Bush today to release all records relating to several controversial business transactions he was involved in as a director of a Texas oil company more than a dozen years ago. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
Democrats had said little about questions being raised regarding the president's dealings as the director of Harkin Energy. That changed when the senior Democrat in the Senate, West Virginia's Robert Byrd, rose to scold the president on the Senate floor.
The administration would do well to take some of its own medicine and make itself more transparent to the American public.
But a White House spokesman said documents on the president's deeds at Harkin will not be released. House Minority Leader Dick Gephardt said that's the wrong course for the president to take.
I think you have a better chance of doing what he seems to be trying to do in speeches if you just put the stuff out. Whatever it is, put it out, get it in front of people, put it on the table, sunshine works, move on.
Gephardt added, none of us is perfect. David Walla, NPR News, the Capitol.
Israel said today that it plans to prosecute a senior Palestinian leader on charges of conspiring in terrorism. Israel's justice ministry said it would try Marwan Barghouti and four other Palestinians in connection with several attacks in Israel. It would be the first time since the establishment of the Palestinian Authority in 1994 that Israel has attempted to try a senior Palestinian official. Barghouti, who's 42, is the leader of the Fatah movement in the West Bank, and recent public opinion polls have shown him to be almost as popular as Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. California and other western states are baking under a heat wave that forecasters say will last through the week. Joe Barr reports from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento.
They're sweltering in the Northern California town of Redding, which hit a record 115 degrees yesterday and is headed for another record today. Terry Hansen works for the town's recreation department, which is overseeing construction of a new municipal pool. That means the old one is out of commission.
Our aquatic center will be a great asset, would have been a great asset this summer as well, but it's under construction. You can't build a $5 million facility without being interrupted in the summer.
Yesterday's heat broke records across California, raising fears of wildfires and power shortages. Forecasters say it's a couple degrees cooler today and most records aren't in danger of falling. But Redding is still a hot spot with a predicted high this afternoon of 116, 2 degrees shy of the all-time high. For NPR News, I'm Joe Barr in Sacramento.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 12 points to close at 8,801 in very heavy trading. The Dow bounced back from an earlier loss of 2.3%. The Nasdaq gained 28 points, or 2.1%. It closed at 1,374. This is NPR News. Texas billionaire Ross Perot testified today before a California State Senate committee that's investigating last year's energy crisis. Perot denied that his company showed wholesale power suppliers how to drive up prices by taking advantage of flaws in the deregulation of California's energy market. The bystander who videotaped an apparent police beating of a handcuffed teenager has been arrested in Los Angeles. Mitchell Crooks was wanted on outstanding warrants in Placer County in Northern California. More from NPR's Ina Jaffe.
Now there's another dramatic arrest video. Mitchell Crooks was taken into custody outside CNN's LA studios, and the network's security cameras captured the event. Crooks appears extremely agitated, fearful. He continually screams, "Help me, even as he's being driven away. Crooks was arrested on outstanding warrants for petty theft and driving under the influence with a hit and run. The Los Angeles district attorney had also been seeking Crooks so he could testify before the grand jury investigating the incident he videotaped. It showed a white police officer from the city of Inglewood grabbing a handcuffed African-American teenager, slamming him face first into the trunk of a patrol car, and then punching him. The incident's now being investigated by the district attorney, the county sheriff, the Inglewood police, and the FBI. Ina Jaffe, NPR News, Los Angeles.
The American Red Cross says it has had very little response to its appeals for donations to help victims of the Texas floods. Red Cross officials say they expect to spend about $12 million on flood relief in Texas, but so far donations for the purpose have amounted to less than $300,000. Texas officials estimate the total flood damage could run as high as $9 billion. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from American Legacy Foundation, informing Americans that women who smoke may increase their risk of infertility. www.americanlegacy.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A new detective is about to enter the mystery world. Adrian Monk is a brilliant crime solver. The problem is, he's also obsessive-compulsive. When he's at a crime scene looking for clues, he might be worrying that he forgot to lock the door. If someone shakes his hand, he has to immediately take out an antibacterial wipe. In order to function, he needs his assistant Sharona at his side. The comedy-drama mystery series Monk premieres tomorrow on the USA Cable Network. The show stars Tony Shalhoub as Monk. The two-hour pilot begins at a crime scene. A dead woman lies on the floor of her apartment, surrounded by detectives looking to the brilliant Monk for direction. Here's what Monk has to say.
The stove.
Over here. It's in the kitchen.
No, I mean my stove. I think I left it on.
It's okay. I checked it as we were leaving.
Are you sure? Did you turn the knob?
Yeah.
The little knob, though.
I turned all the knobs. The stove is off, Adrian.
Excuse me, sir. We believe it was a burglary gone sour. She walked in, she surprised him, he panicked.
No.
He got the knife from the kitchen.
No. This was no burglary.
It wasn't.
He tried to make it look like one, but this guy was cold as ice.
Tony Shalhoub starred in the films Big Night, The Siege, and Spy Kids, and he plays the alien porn broker in Men in Black 2. He starred in two other TV series, Wings and Stark Raving Mad, playing characters who were quirky, but not quite as obsessive as Monk.
Anyway, after he killed Miss...
Nicole Vasquez, 25.
Yeah, Miss Vasquez. He hung around. He was looking for something.
Looking for what?
I don't know. He checked something on her computer. He could have erased a file.
Anything else?
Yes, he's tall. He's 6'3", maybe 6'4".
What about the pilot light?
Because, you know, sometimes
fine.
It goes out. Do you remember the last time it almost went out?
Do you want me to drive all the way back to the city and check the stove?
No.
I mean, is that what you're telling me to do?
No. Would you? Could you? That would be great.
Oh.
What you can't tell by listening to that scene is that Monk is compelled to keep touching the top of the desk lamp in the victim's apartment. Tony Shalhoub told me that the idea for that particular compulsion came when he was rehearsing with the director of the pilot, Dean Pariseau.
There was this enormous gooseneck lamp on the desk at this crime scene. And Dean just went over and said, hey, what do you think of this lamp? And how about, you know, you... just as another thing to kind of distract you, what if you get caught up in this lamp? And it was one of those moments where I touched the top of the lamp, and it almost was as if the whole character kind of just came to me in that second. I mean, I had been working on it, and I had been sort of experimenting with various things, but it just one fingertip on this desk lamp, it kind of just gave me this charge, I guess you'd say. A jolt, and I've thought of that now as the kind of, you know, the core of this guy.
Do you have any strange compulsions regarding acting? Do you have any things that you have to do before starting a performance that remind you of the kind of obsessive compulsive patterns that Monk has?
Yeah, I have I don't have any superstitions per se, but I have habits, I guess you could say rituals. Okay, yeah, they're superstitions, I guess. It's all the same thing, really. In the end, it all is kind of the same. I do less and less the older I get. I don't mean I do less and less work, but I do less and less psyching myself up. I've been kind of trying to, for lack of a better phrase, untraining myself. When we're young actors, we're loading ourselves up with preparation. And but as I kind of evolve through it in later years, I find that the real preparation comes from sort of from not loading up and from kind of doing the opposite of that, which is clearing away the clutter and trying to stay as open as possible to whatever, you know, whatever's coming to me.
I imagine in acting classes you learn how to loosen up your body and be free with your body, but when you're playing a character like Monk is so inhibited and such the kind of control freak that his body actually has to be really tight and
yes.
Registering kind of strain all the time. Can you
tension.
Talk attention? Yes. Yeah. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, Monk is keeps everything very, very close, to him, to his body. His arms stay in his. There's nothing kind of. There's a certain distance he wants to keep from the world, from objects in the world, and from people. That's the reason Monk never wears a tie. I think you'll see this character with his shirt buttoned. But with a suit jacket or a sport jacket, but never with a tie. That was a decision that we made, when we were kind of coming up with the character, because I thought, well, first of all, ties are impossible to keep straight, so that's something that would just be way too high maintenance for him. And ties, they can sort of flap out and get caught on things and get stuck in a fan. I mean, so. This is all part of the physical life of the character, keeping things really, really close and tightly reined. I just have to remind myself when I'm doing the part to kind of relax and release. Otherwise, by the end of the day, I'm just a ball of knots.
Tony Shalhoub stars in the new TV series Monk. My guest, Andy Breckman, is the writer and executive producer of the series. He's also written for Late Night with David Letterman, Saturday Night Live, and TV Funhouse. Here's another scene from the pilot of Monk. A young man with information about the murder victim has just been found dead in his car in a ditch off a rain-slicked country road. The obsessive-compulsive detective Adrian Monk and his assistant Sharona wait on the road while the police chief goes down to the ditch.
What are you doing? Come on down. The accident scene's down here.
He's not wearing the right shoes today.
Not wearing the right shoes today. Well, look, there's nothing to do here. The coroner's already called it. It's a single car accident.
No, this was no accident. There's no skid marks on the road.
It's wet! You're not the only detective here, Monk. I checked for skid marks. No, it happens all the time on this hill. You hit this curve at 85, 90 miles an
hour. The police chief is played by Ted Levine, who played the serial killer in The Silence of the Lambs. I asked Monk's writer, Andy Breckman, if he consulted with psychiatrists while creating the obsessive-compulsive detective.
Before I wrote it, I did talk to some professionals just to make sure I wasn't completely off base. But the cluster of symptoms that we gave this character, and when I say we, I mean the writers and Tony. Tony's been contributing more than his share. To developing the character. This particular cluster of symptoms, I don't think really exist in the real world. He's obsessed with orderliness. If a picture on the wall is a little crooked, Monk will not be able to question this suspect until the picture on the wall has been straightened out. We have a scene in a later episode where Monk is talking to a witness and he looks out a window, and in the next building, through the picture window, he sees a picture that's crooked and just excuses himself and walks downstairs and then to the next building and can't continue until that picture is straightened. So that, I don't know if that exists in the real world, but it's fun to watch him overcoming it on TV.
One of the more obscure obsessions here is that he has to touch the tops of lamps when he sees them. Where'd you get that one from?
That was Tony on the set. He started to touch this desk lamp, and it actually was a big decision, because once you give a character in a pilot a character quirk like that, you're locked into it. So we're very careful. If somebody comes up with an idea that involves Monk not wanting to handle money or cash, that might be funny in this episode, but then we have to ask ourselves, that means if this show goes for 5 or 6 or 7 years, we have a character who can't take out a wallet and buy something, you know? So we have to be very, very careful. We don't want to put him in a straitjacket, so we want to have fun with him. So we've come up with 3 or 4 basic problems that he has. He's germophobic. That's one thing. He can't shake hands without wiping his hands immediately afterwards. Sharona, Dr. Watson, is always there with some handy wipes. And he's obsessed with things being arranged in perfect order. He can't stand to have things slightly askew on a table or on a wall. And those are the main compulsions we've given him.
He's afraid of heights.
Certainly afraid of heights. Who isn't? He's a character that if he had his druthers, he would not leave his apartment ever. He would just stay home. That's what he would rather do. But he has to pay the rent, so every once in a while there's a murder, and Sharona and the San Francisco police drag him out to the murder scene because there's no one better once he's at the murder scene. But he's there very reluctantly.
So do you have any obsessive compulsive behaviors that you could kind of hook into and use to inform your scripts?
I have never met anyone who doesn't, if you really get to know them. Everyone has quirks and compulsions. I will wash my hands more often than a person might normally be expected to wash their hands, especially if I've been shaking hands. I also have been known to lock and then relock and then re-lock my front door in the middle of the night. But if you get to know people, I think everyone has quirks or superstitions, and I think that's why people are responding so well to this. This is sort of an exaggeration of that.
So what's some of the best advice you got either from psychiatrists or from people who are obsessive compulsive?
The best advice, do you mean to...
In shaping the character?
I think what's interesting about this particular, I guess it's a disease or problem, is that people that have it, in many cases, maybe most cases, are aware they have it, unlike a lot of other mental illnesses. They're very aware of it. Many people who compulsively wash their hands 100 times a day, they know it's unusual. They're embarrassed by it. They apologize for it, but they can't stop themselves. And Monk, I think, falls into that category. He won't deny he's difficult to live with. He won't deny that his assistant, Sharona, has a very, very difficult job, but he just can't help himself. As he says repeatedly, I am what I am.
It's funny because so many detectives in the hard-boiled tradition are able to, like, shrug off a lot. They have to be able to because they're exposed to death and chaos all the time. And to see somebody who has all these obsessions and compulsions be in that tradition is kind of amusing in itself.
Yes, there's a long tradition of detectives that are overcoming various problems and have different quirks. Ironside was in a wheelchair.
That's true, right.
I don't know, Beretta had a parrot on his shoulder. I don't know,
Perry Mason was chubby and square.
Yes, Perry Mason was hopelessly square, that he had to overcome that. I wonder if they talked to square people before their pilot and Perry Mason. So it is a noble tradition of giving detectives obstacles to overcome. I think we've given Monk maybe more than his share, to the point where every scene, talking to every witness and every suspect, becomes really, really an uphill battle for the guy.
My guest is Andy Breckman, the writer and executive producer of the new TV series Monk. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Andy Breckman, is the writer and executive producer of the new USA cable network comedic mystery series Monk about an obsessive-compulsive detective. Now, you had to come up with some explanation of how somebody who has all of these potentially crippling problems ended up being a brilliant detective on the police force. So, I mean, what was the process like of trying to come up for an explanation that would make this whole plot premise work?
Well, exactly. That's what a writer does when he writes a pilot. He comes up with often called a Bible, a backstory for the character. In this case, Monk always was sort of tightly wound, always had a few problems, but he kept them in check. He kept them under control, mainly because he married well. He was married to his wife, Trudy, for many years. And Monk's real problems begin when Trudy was murdered. It's the one murder that Monk can't solve. He just can't see it clearly. He's obsessed with it. Trudy, his wife, was killed by a car bomb 3 or 4 years ago. And her death sent him spiraling, sent him into a tailspin. And he actually was bedridden, like Brian Wilson. He couldn't leave the bed for a couple of years. And only now, when we meet him, is he gradually getting his sea legs back. And he's taking some consulting jobs, in large part due to the work of Sharona, played by Biddy Schramm, who is sort of his Dr. Watson slash nurse.
And she's somebody who lives this really messy life. She has, like, a teenage kid who skateboards and is all kind of, like, tattooed and pierced and stuff. And, you know, her house is in chaos. Did you intentionally create somebody who is in many ways the opposite of the detective?
Well, we wanted someone who was kind of streetwise and kind of be an everyman, kind of like Dr. Watson writing his memoirs, got to remark on how unique Sherlock Holmes was. We kind of see Monk in large part through Sharona's eyes, and we've talked a lot about Tony's work, but this actress, Biddy Schramm, is also just remarkable. And so all of Monk's foibles, she gets to comment on, and she's the one that won't take his any crap from him and calls him on stuff.
Now, you know, this week's episode is the pilot, and it's a movie-length episode in which all the characters are established and a mystery presents itself and is, of course, solved. But then you have to carry on week after week. What was it like for you to go
through? We do?
Yeah.
what was it like for you to
do the movie-length thing and then feel like, well, you have to have enough left over to keep exploring the characters and to come up with, you know, with more and more plots?
Well, the characters are so much fun that actually might be the easier part. Coming up with clever little puzzles that are intriguing and would hold, say, my attention for an hour, that was more of a challenge. And it's just hard work and lots of hours, and we have to be sort of selective. For every 500 ideas that we generate, we like one or two of them.
How do you come up with your mysteries? Because they have to be fairly elaborate in the way that people from, like, Columbo or Sherlock Holmes have had elaborate plots.
Well, you've just mentioned my two sources. I mean, Columbo is the gold standard, as far as I'm concerned, the Levinson and Link series from the early 70s, and, of course, Sherlock Holmes. And how do I come up with the plots? I've actually been a mystery fan for years and have been sort of hoarding ideas for years. I'm not a big fan of whodunits. I'm not a big fan of the traditional Agatha Christie, there are five suspects and we put them all in a room and the detective tells you which one it is at the end. I'm more of a fan of how did he do it, or why did he do it, asking other questions. For example, the an early episode involves a judge who is murdered in San Francisco, and Monk suspects a man who lives across town of committing the murder. But this man weighs 800 pounds. He's one of these morbidly obese guys that can't leave the bed. He can't even fit out the door. Even if he could leave the bed and walk, he couldn't fit down the elevator. So the question in that episode is not who did it, but how did this fat bastard manage to do it? And that those kind of puzzles intrigue me. And asking those questions combined with the character stuff and the comedy stuff, I think, is the mix we want.
Now, you mentioned earlier that one of your compulsions, which isn't totally out of control, but you know you wash your hands more often than the average person, and that
yes.
even though you know you may wash it more often than necessary, you do it anyways. Ever since writing Monk, are you more self-conscious about the amount of times you wash your hands every day? Has it affected that particular part of your behavior?
Well, around the house, my wife and kids now call me Monk when I do it. So that maybe is the biggest change. No, I'm just I'm one of these guys. I can live with a little ridicule, and I know it's sort of ridiculous. I don't think I get sick less than other people because I wash my hands more. I have met people that won't shake hands at all. Have you ever met people like that? That will reach
not
for
yet.
You
no.
With like a
no.
Oh, really? I have met them. There are people that avoid shaking hands. So I'm not as bad as some, so you give me some credit for that. I get a couple of points. There are people worse than me. I want that on the record.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks. That was pretty painless.
Well, that's a high compliment.
Yeah, I know that was your goal.
That's my goal, create as little pain as possible.
It's what I say to you and my dentist when I'm done.
Exactly.
That was pretty painless.
Andy Breckman is the writer and executive producer of the new TV series, Monk. The pilot will be shown tomorrow evening on the USA Cable Network. The series will continue on Friday nights. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward recalls the early days of the Byrds. And we talk about Lovely and Amazing, a new movie about women plagued with insecurities about their looks. We'll meet the film's writer-director Nicole Holofcener and star Catherine Keener. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie, Lovely and Amazing, is a comedy that considers women's self-consciousness about their looks and the real and imagined pressures to be thin and beautiful. In a few minutes, we'll meet one of the film's stars, Catherine Keener. First, we talk with the writer and director, Nicole Holofcener. She also made the independent film Walking and Talking, a comedy about relationships. Lovely and Amazing is about a 50-something mother, her two 30-something daughters, and her adopted 8-year-old African-American daughter. The mother, played by Brenda Blethyn, thinks she's too heavy, so she's having liposuction. The African-American daughter wants her hair straightened. The daughter, played by Catherine Keener, thinks her husband doesn't find her attractive anymore. The other daughter, played by Emily Mortimer, is an actress trying to make it in Hollywood, and in her work, looks really do count. She's very thin and quite pretty, yet she worries that her arms are flabby and she's not attractive enough. Her insecurities seem justified when she's turned down for a role by a director who doesn't find her sexy. But when she tries to talk with her boyfriend about this, he's not concerned. The boyfriend is played by James LaGrosse.
I think you're sexy.
Can you give me a job?
I can have sex with you.
Don't joke, this is hideous.
The profession is hideous.
What?
I have to work.
You don't have a lot of sympathy for me, do you? So, since I chose this profession, I shouldn't feel bad when I get rejected.
This is so boring.
Boring?
Elizabeth, it's not personal. Maybe you should date an actor or something, someone who goes through the same things as you.
You don't want to see me anymore.
I don't think I can give you what you want.
And what is it that you think I want?
You want a girlfriend. Someone you can talk about your upper arms with.
That's so mean.
Nicole Holofcener, do you think both sides are right in this scene?
I do think both sides are right. I'm glad that you can see that. I think that she is completely justified in feeling hurt and humiliated and exploited. She was all those things. And at the same time, she is tediously boring. And I think if she hadn't talked the day before about her flabby arms, maybe today he could hear about this rejection and not be tired of it. But it's the 10th time she's talked about this. And so he can't gauge really when something is catastrophic or not. It's kind of all catastrophic. And he's had it with her. I don't feel like he's the bad guy. And I don't feel like she's crazy to feel that upset. I think they're really ill-suited is really the ultimate thing. That's what I'm saying, is that these people do not belong together. They might be fabulous with somebody else, but not together.
Why did you want to make a movie about the insecurities women have about their looks?
It certainly didn't come from any kind of theoretical or cerebral place in me. Like, I was interested in these ideas. I was much more interested in the topics from a personal point of view. I just felt compelled to, lay out for everyone to see just how obsessed I can be with my appearance and everyone else I know. I thought that it was really interesting how intelligent women with full lives and attractive enough bodies and attractive enough faces spend an inordinate amount of time obsessing about our looks.
What are your issues?
God forbid my body look too womanly, you know, the hips, the butt, the thing. And I'm a relatively thin person. I mean, I have a fine figure. But I guess we look at those magazines and think we should have boyish figures. That's a whole other kettle of fish, right? I've got a nice fine nose on my face, and I look like a real person, you know, so I have insecurities about my flaws.
Do you see the women in this movie, and do you see yourself as obsessing on physical appearance, even though intellectually you know better?
Absolutely. Of course I know better. And I think that there's a real schism in many parts of our lives where you know better, and that doesn't make any difference. We know better not to go out with that person. We know better not to take this job. But our hearts and our insecurities and whatever has screwed us up from the very start is sometimes leading us. And that's what I thought was true for these women.
The reality is that although you don't want to be judged on your looks or have people judged on their looks, as the director of the film, in a visual medium, you are judging people on their looks, even if you're judging them in standards that aren't the typical, mm-hmm. you know, glamour magazine kind of standard. So it must really get to you.
It does. Auditioning people for the audition scene was just crazy. You know, they were reading the audition scene, feeling exposed, feeling like a piece of meat, and there I was judging them, thinking, ah, she's too pretty. Ah, she's too thin. Ah, she's too fat. You know, the same stuff. You can't help it. I'm casting a movie. I've got to find the right person. It's, you know, there's a lot of irony in it, and for me personally, and I was just conscious of it all. I really couldn't make sense of it or figure out whether I was doing a right thing or a wrong thing.
There's a nude scene in your movie, but it's not meant to be a sexy nude scene. Emily Mortimer, who plays the actress after she's rejected for not being sexy enough in an audition, she has an affair with an actor who she auditioned with, and she gets out of bed naked and asks the actor who she's just slept with to appraise her body, to go over every detail of it and basically rate it.
Mm-hmm.
Was it hard to convince Emily Mortimer to do that scene?
No, it was not hard to convince Emily to do that scene at all. She was chomping at the bit. I think she was glad when it was over with. She read the script and understood how integral that scene was to the script, that it was very much a part of it. It was not exploitive. It would not be sexy. And just she understood how it would help her character grow and how necessary it was for her arc. So she was ready and willing. And she knew we couldn't, you know, fool around with, you know, over the shoulder and a sort of a half breast. Or she went, no, I got to be standing there. And I think personally she was challenged by it as well. She's an actress and with a certain amount of insecurity and not thankfully as much as Elizabeth has. She was looking forward to it. A lot of actors who wanted to play the part were actually looking forward to that scene. Some were not. Some said, I would love to play this character, but I can't stand there naked. And usually it was well-known actresses that felt that way. They've already had the download experience, I think, of having been on the internet and stuff, and they didn't like it.
I think people are more prurient when it comes to a famous person taking off their clothes than they are about an actress who's still in the process of getting known.
Yeah, and it was part of my decision to cast someone who was less known as well. I mean, I'm usually drawn to faces that are new to me, not ones that I've seen over and over and over again, which is not to say so many of those actors are great. I just thought, for somebody standing there naked, you can't be saying, oh, my God, there's so-and-so's breasts. It's just already the scene will take you out of reality so easily. I didn't want that to be another one of those reasons.
Nicole Holofcener wrote and directed the new film Lovely and Amazing. Coming up, we meet one of the film's stars, Catherine Keener. This is Fresh Air. Catherine Keener is one of the stars of the new film Lovely and Amazing, written and directed by Nicole Holofcener. Keener also starred in Holofcener's first movie, Walking and Talking. Keener's other films include Being John Malkovich, Death to Smoochie, The Real Blonde, and Living in Oblivion. Like all the women in the new movie Lovely and Amazing, Keener's character has insecurities which are connected to her looks. She's a former homecoming queen. Now she's worried her husband doesn't find her attractive anymore. What's also keeping her self-esteem in the dumps is that no one wants to buy her artwork, and she's unemployed. In this scene, she's gazing blankly at cartoons on TV, eating cookies, when her husband comes home from work.
Hi.
Hi.
How was work?
Where's Maddie?
Reading in her room. Come sit with me.
What are you watching?
Hickory Dog.
We haven't had sex in so long.
It hasn't been that long.
Yes, it has. Donna says, how often do you guys have sex? I'm too embarrassed to tell her the truth.
Why does Donna want to know how often we have sex?
I'm just talking.
So you want to have sex so that you can have a good answer for Donna?
Why do you have to be such a...
I don't understand. Are you saying that you want to have sex with me? That you miss it? Or are you accusing me of something? Because that's what it feels like.
Catherine Keener told me she's faced issues similar to the ones faced in the movie by the character of her sister, the actress.
I remember I had an audition once, and the director thought that I had done a fairly good job in the reading, but my problem was that I wasn't sexy. And he didn't say sexy enough or for this part or anything. He just said, you know, it's basically labeled me that way. And it was good because, you know, it gave me some perspective on how arbitrary it all is, you know. Because at the time, I just thought, well, God, I really can't do anything about that. You know, I can't work that out, you know. So
you can't study with a great actor to learn how to be sexy.
Exactly.
But in a way, you can, because don't you think that some people who you wouldn't think of as being sexy, like they do a certain something on screen and they become very sexy? Like even yourself, you have some roles where you look more like, you know, the next door neighbor, and other roles where you're really a seductress.
Mm. Well, makeup and lighting go a long way towards helping that. But I do think that for me, I think what kind of helped me with that was that I realized that I just have to kind of be who I am, because I can't fight those forces who are just going to decide what they think about me. It's just, you know, viewed through their perspective, and I can't do anything about that. So, but for me, that quality is something that's inherent in a person. It's not,
right?
You know what I mean? It's, if it's an affectation, it comes across to me anyway as one. So, that's what I mean. I could maybe affect it, but it would just be a stereotype to me because I don't really know what that is.
Now, getting back to auditions, what are some of the other things you've been told when you haven't gotten jobs?
Oh, I was told I acquitted myself nicely of what I don't know, I guess. And I was told, you know, not this, not pretty enough, a lot of times, especially for television, I got the note back was that I came across as too hard. I know it's hard to believe, considering the parts I get usually are pretty tough. But I think that they were too much for, you know, television. I think they want, even if the character is described as a hardened person, they want her really soft, in my opinion.
Right.
Hard, but not like life hard.
So when you like get TV. Notes back like that, where somebody's saying that either you're not sexy enough or you're too hard or whatever, does that get to you? I mean, you said with the sexy thing that was actually useful to hear that, but...
Well, it was useful in retrospect, but at the time it was demoralizing, and I actually left town. I left for about 3 months. I got out of here. I got in my car and drove away.
You left town for 3 months? Where'd you go?
Well, I went to Roswell, New Mexico.
Look for UFOs?
Yes, kind of.
Why'd you go there?
Well, my husband was working there, and
I took
my dog and I packed up his cello. He needed his cello, so I drove it out there.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, it was at the height of what we call pilot season. Do you know what that is? I don't. But in television, there are about 3 months that start maybe January or February for 3 months, where they make a lot of pilots. And for actors, it's a very busy time because the possibility of getting jobs goes way up. So because there are just a lot of jobs to be had, and it's not the time that you leave town, but that's exactly when I left, because I thought, I don't really care.
Right. Catherine Keener is my guest, and she's starring in the new movie Lovely and Amazing. Remember when I was saying that You've had some roles in which you've been a kind of very, you know, average, like your best friend or your next door neighbor kind of character, and other movies right. in which you've been really quite seductive. In the quite seductive category, there's Being John Malkovich, in which you play a woman who John Malkovich and Cameron Diaz fall in love with. And it's it's a movie, for people who haven't seen it, with a very funny and bizarre premise, which is that people have found a porthole that leads you to the brain of the actor John Malkovich. And when you enter the portal, you experience everything from his point of view.
For 15 minutes.
Yeah, and then you're thrown out.
Exactly.
Thrown out and you're behind.
Ejected onto the New Jersey Turnpike.
So just getting back to the person who told you that you weren't sexy enough, what was it like in this movie to be the seductress? Because you seduce a man and a woman in this.
Well,
two men and a woman.
Yeah. Well, Cameron's easy. No, she. No. But no, it was wild. I mean, I just kept trying to convince Spike that he was casting the wrong person because I thought, you've got me confused with somebody else. But you know, I really honestly thought that I should have auditioned for Lottie, the character that Cameron played. But he really. He kept saying, no, I think that, you know, you would be writer for this part, Maxine. So we read practically the whole script in a like 2-hour marathon audition. And I was nervous and scared. And I kept thinking, this isn't me, this isn't me, this isn't me. And he, you know, kept giving me an encouraging pat and saying, yeah, I think you can do it. I do. And but it turned out to be a blast. All of it was a lot of fun. And I don't know. Spike just made it really easy on me. He just would help me out of every corner I backed myself into, and it was fun.
Now, you met your husband, the actor Dermot Mulroney, I think on the set of a movie. He's one of the stars of the new movie that you're in, Lovely and Amazing, mm-hmm. although I don't know if you're in any scenes together. I don't think so.
We're not, no.
How did you meet on the set? Were you in both acting in the same film?
Yeah, we did a film together. It was actually our first film called Survival Quest. And
it was the first film for each of you?
Yeah, yeah. We had both just come out to Los Angeles. And I don't know, we were friends for a very long time, and he was a lot of fun when we were working. And we were both involved in an accident while we were shooting, a river accident. We were jumping, was this like this group of Outward Bound people, and he was an ex-con and I was getting a divorce, that kind of thing. And we were running away from kind of the radical splinter group, you know, who was out to get us, and we had to jump into this river, the Kern River, which is a very dangerous river here in California, and there had been even a lot of fatalities that summer and all this stuff. But anyway, we were really underprepared for it, and didn't have any flotation devices on and all this stuff. But consequently, a couple of us didn't swim into our mark, I being the first, and then Dermot jumped in to save me. And the producer of the film actually jumped in, and he had to go to the hospital, his heart stopped, the whole thing. It was almost drowning, and it was awful. But after that, I don't know, things kind of changed a little bit for everybody. Especially the people involved in it, in the accident. And we became really good friends. And then I guess maybe 4 or 5 months later, we were looping for the film, you know, doing ADR. And we just started going out.
Did you have any reservations about becoming romantically involved with somebody else in the industry, somebody who is an actor?
No, I didn't have any reservations at all. I liked it. Actually, I think, and ultimately, you know, I still feel like it's a great thing. It just depends on the person. I mean, for me, he and I, you know, we help each other a lot, and we have an understanding for each other. I don't know if, for example, in Lovely and Amazing, Dermot and Emily Mortimer, who plays my sister Elizabeth in it, they have that scene where she gets out of bed naked and says, you know, just basically tell me everything that's wrong with me. You can also say what's right. And he does. And, you know, I don't know people ask me about that, which is the reason I'm bringing it up. But they ask, how did it feel to know your husband was doing that? And I have insight into that because I'm in the same profession, and I know that it's a weird thing and it's an uncomfortable thing, and you have to make the best of it and believe in what you're doing. And so for me, it actually wasn't even, I didn't even have to process it at all. It was just like, oh, you got to do your work, you know. And I actually further thought that Emily and Dermot, you know, Emily, knowing my husband as I do, I knew that she was in really good hands as far as, you know, partner in that scene goes, that Dermot would be really, you know, would take care of her. There she was, all exposed and stuff. Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it was my pleasure, Terry.
Catherine Keener stars in the new movie Lovely and Amazing. She's also in the forthcoming films Full Frontal and Simone. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward on The Byrds. This is Fresh Air. The Byrds were the first American band to seriously challenge the British invasion, and they succeeded in part because by the time their music reached the public's ears, they had rehearsed until they were tight and professional. Recordings of these rehearsals have circulated for years under the title Pre-Flight. These sessions are collected on a double CD on Sundazed Records. It inspired our rock historian, Ed Ward, to explore the prehistory of the band.
It all started at the Troubadour, which was L.A.'s top folk club in 1964. Jim Dixon, a producer at World Pacific Records, heard a folk singer, David Crosby, and liked what he heard. He asked him to stop by their studios to cut a demo, maybe so they could build a group around him. The singer agreed, as long as Dixon didn't tell the other folkies. Interestingly, the two had someone in common, Dino Valenti, or Chet Powers, a mysterious Bay Area songwriter. Crosby had stayed with Valenti on a recent trip north, and Dixon's music publishing company published his songs. Naturally, one became part of the demo.
Love is but a song we sing. Fear's the way we die. You can make the mountains ring or make the angels cry. Know the dove is not know why.
Meanwhile, Jim McGuinn, a Chicago folkie with some showbiz experience, had been facing hostile audiences as he stood up and sang I Want to Hold Your Hand with an acoustic 12-string guitar. Once again in the Troubadour, McGuinn met Gene Clark, a songwriter on the run from various surf bands, and one day as they were working out some songs there, David Crosby sat down and joined them. McGuinn had run across Crosby before and wasn't sure he wanted him horning in on what seemed to be a good thing when Crosby spoke the magic words. Hey guys, I know a guy who has a studio we can use for free. Calling themselves the Jet Set, they went into the studio with Dixon and cut two tracks which Elektra Records put out on a single, labeled as being by the Beefeaters.
Every time I see you smile, come to me, don't be loud. Let me tell you how my heart goes wild. Please
The single, with studio musicians playing on it, died, but it showed promise. Brian Wilson encouraged the group and said they'd almost made it. Dixon recruited Chris Hillman, a bluegrass player he'd worked with, to play bass, and then came Michael Clark on drums. To get a feeling for playing together, they did some acoustic sessions, recording some originals, and because Dixon felt that someone else's great song was better than your own mediocre one, a Bob Dylan song. They tried that one electric, too. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me in the jingle jangle morning. I'll come follow you. After which, they gave up for the moment. They'd get it right later. That electric version of Mr. Tambourine Man, though, featured McGuinn's new toy, a 12-string Rickenbacker electric guitar. It was a challenge for the former folky, and he rose to it. Armed with it, he began writing songs with Gene Clark, and they sounded good.
You showed me how to do exactly what you do, how I fell in love with you.
Clark was a songwriting machine, churning out a half dozen songs a week, showing them to Hillman and Michael Clark, then bringing them to the studio at night so they could bounce them off of McGuinn and Crosby, and Dixon, who was very interested in building up his publishing company. He also told all of his friends about the group he was working with, giving photographer Barry Feinstein run of the sessions and bringing Lenny Bruce and Bob Dylan to the studio. Dylan heard the band nervously perform electric versions of some of his songs and gave his blessing. The buzz paid off. In November 1964, the Byrds, as they christened themselves over a Thanksgiving dinner, were signed by Columbia Records, thanks in part to enthusiasm from Miles Davis, of all people, and they never looked back. Soon, Sunset Strip and the world would be theirs.
Ed Ward is a writer living in Berlin.
I was really good to her, but how she broke my heart.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Al Banks. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Lauren Krenzel. I'm Terry Gross.
Now I wonder if she'll ever wanna settle down. Oh.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Mother Rocket, a collection of stories by Rita Cerisi, author of Pink Slip. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The history of the world, my sweet.
The Kennedy Center is featuring a festival of Stephen Sondheim musicals. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from Sondheim and some of the people who've worked with him. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Everybody goes out well with beer.